Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's Jav Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to open up with a call from U.S. Senator Chris Murphy. We'll get his take on the President's final State of the Union address, Senator Murphy's continuing work on issues related to gun violence and mental health, and we'll get some important advice regarding America's fight to destroy ISIS in our lifetime. Then we'll transition to the decidedly lighter subject of puppies. That's right, puppies. We'll welcome a trio of representatives from Guiding Eyes for the Blind and learn how you can help make a difference by supporting the cause or volunteering to be a Guiding Eyes puppy raiser in 2016. Then we'll wrap introducing you to yet another worthy grassroots nonprofit born out of the tragedy of a lost child with the founder of One Innocent Life. So stay tuned. The life you save might be your own child's. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, Jav Vocat, right after this news. The Community Foundation for Greater New Haven is accepting grant applications from eligible nonprofits through Thursday, March 31st for its responsive grants process in conjunction with the Valley Community Foundation. Responsive grants are generally awarded to address operating costs, programmatic or capacity building needs. Grant amounts start at $7,500 and eligibility restrictions apply. Applicants who may be unfamiliar with the grant process are encouraged to register for an informational webinar coming up in mid-February. Just learn more at the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, cfgnh.org. We're opening this morning, as promised, with U.S. Senator Chris Murphy. He's on the line with us from Washington. Chris, thanks for joining us on the program.
Yeah, it was great to be with you, John. Thanks for having me.
And it's been too long. I'm glad you were able to make a few minutes to talk with us and the folks here in Connecticut. Let's go to the news about the State of the Union. I barely caught a glimpse of you on a couple of camera sweeps of the room. But tell us a little bit about now your impression of this year's event versus some that you may have attended in the past.
Well, it was a very different speech as anyone who watched it could figure out. He really was, talking, above the heads of Congress to the American people. And, in a lot of ways, I think this was a speech that was designed to rebut a lot of the rhetoric that is surrounding the presidential campaign. I think he's really worried that the sort of plays to the base that's happening within the presidential campaign is really dangerous. And, whether it's calls to keep Muslims out of the country or suggestions that you can carpet bomb away terrorist organizations, I think he was trying to make the American people understand that, none of the problems that we face can be handled in sound bites, and that if anybody is peddling an easy solution to eradicating terrorism or creating jobs, then you should probably think twice about that argument. So it was a very interesting speech, and I really did think that you have to place that speech in the context of the presidential campaign to really understand where he was going with it.
I remember talking with your colleague, Senator Blumenthal, just a few months after he was elected. And at the time, he was already ruminating about how broken the system is in Washington. And it seemed like in this State of the Union, there was also a lot of alluding to that. Kind of lowering the president's gaze and talking right to everyone in the room.
It was remarkable in its candor, right? The president came out and said his greatest regret is that he wasn't able to cure the partisanship of Washington. And he said very clearly, and I agree, that it's gotten worse while he's been here. And, of course, he came into office as someone who pledged to be a uniter. The problem was, unification takes two. Somebody else has to be willing to unify with you. And he just didn't have that partner. I mean, unfortunately, the Republican leader of the Senate said as soon as he got here that their number one goal was not to create jobs or protect America. It was to defeat President Obama. And so that's what they did. Every calculation they made was a political one. And so I think it was very hard for him to make good on that promise to try to make Washington work again. And I don't think he was perfect at it. I think he made mistakes as well. I think he referenced that in his speech. But that is an aspect of this job that makes it not terribly fun, the fact that there's way too much sniping and partisan bickering and not enough cooperation. At the end of last year, without a lot of fanfare, we got a lot done, actually. I mean, we passed some really big bills, a major budget, a spending bill, a long-term tax deal, and a replacement for No Child Left Behind. So we did get a lot of stuff done last year, and he referenced that. I think his hope is that that's not just a blip on the historical radar screen, that maybe we can take some steps to make sure that that's more the rule rather than the exception of how this place operates.
The other thing is, just a few days ahead of the State of the Union, we heard a big announcement about executive action. As you know, I'm very close to the Sandy Hook situation. He was surrounded by a couple of folks from Sandy Hook, as well as a number of other individuals whose lives were touched and destroyed in some respects by gun violence. While that very heightened piece of information that he gave a few days earlier seemed to resonate for several days around the country, there wasn't that much talk about gun violence during the State of the Union.
Not a surprise to those of us who have been very involved in this executive action. So, I had really been the leader in the Senate on pushing the president to do this executive action. I had heard about the idea from Gabby Gifford's organization, and I brought it to the White House. They had actually already seen it by the time I was talking to them, but we pushed them for about 6 months to get this done. And then I went over to the White House the day before he announced it, and he actually told us very explicitly, the group of us that went over there, I think it was on Monday night of last week, he said, I'm doing this executive action this week and spending my entire week talking about anti-gun violence measures so that it doesn't overwhelm the State of the Union, because I want the State of the Union to be about much broader themes. So in that way, I think it was very intentional that it wasn't part of the State of the Union speech, although it was, because the visual that probably everyone will take away is that image of our governor, Dan Malloy, sitting one seat away from the First Lady with an empty seat representing the victims of gun violence. And I was at the speech with Mark Barton, who lost his little son Daniel, as in the shooting. And he said, all of us know what that feels like to have an empty seat next to you. And I think a lot of people will remember that scene from that speech as much as they remember anything that he said.
And we'd be remiss in taking on this subject with you, Senator Murphy, without recognizing the work that you've done so far and the great goals that you still have yet to tackle regarding mental health reform. How's that going?
Well, I'll pay the compliment in kind. Obviously, you've been a real hero to the families in terms of how you've covered this tragedy with a degree of respect and for those that are grieving in a way that everybody appreciates. I think that this is an issue that's not going away, and one that, if you're honest, has no one simple solution. Gun laws have to be changed. It just makes no sense that we allow criminals to get guns and we allow people to possess military style firearms like assault weapons, but there's also a very broken mental health system out there. And if you read the Child Advocates report on Adam Lanza, you see that he was failed by our behavioral health system. So I spent all of 2014 putting together the most comprehensive, most bipartisan mental health reform bill that Congress may have ever seen. I have now, as of last week, 8 Republican co-sponsors, 8 Democratic co-sponsors. We keep it one for one, and we have a lot of momentum. We are going to have a hearing next week on the bill. There's momentum in both the House and the Senate to get a big major reform to our behavioral health system. And that means putting more resources in, making sure there's more beds, that there's more clinicians that can see people faster and quicker. It means making sure that we're connecting our behavioral health system with our physical health system. One of the things things in Adam Lanza's record was that his primary care physician had no notes about his behavioral health history, which makes no sense. You've got to have those two systems connected. And then it means taking on the stigma by passing new legislation that forces insurance companies to really cover mental health in a way that they don't today. So we're hopeful to get this done. It's a big bill. It's a big proposal. But if we're serious about how to put a check on gun violence, it isn't just about our gun laws. It's also about our behavioral health laws.
Hmm. For the folks that might be listening who are into that whole us and them thing, just talk for a minute about what it's like when you are trying to build that bipartisan consensus and you're actually in the room one-on-one with a Republican colleague and you're making your pitch. Is it as divisive a situation that you have to overcome as some of the national talk show hosts and others purport it to be?
No, and I think that's a really important question, John. So this place is not as partisan as the talk shows make it seem, right? So the talk shows are all about sort of covering and promoting dysfunction here. Now, this is a very dysfunctional place, but there's a lot of cooperation happening on a daily basis that doesn't get covered. Bill Cassidy, who's my Republican lead co-sponsor on this bill, he's a really conservative Republican senator from the Deep South, partnering with a pretty progressive Democratic senator from the Northeast. So we went on the talk shows when we introduced the bill, but not many people have covered it since then because it's not really exciting to cover the two parties getting along. And we've been really careful about how to build this bill. We made compromises. Senator Cassidy made compromises on the legislation. I did. And then we went around and carefully built co-sponsorships, one Democrat and one Republican at a time, so that we could have nobody saying that this was just a partisan Republican bill or partisan Democratic bill. So if you're careful about doing things in a non-political way, you can get things done. And I think that's why our bill is one of the few that might actually get done in an election year, 2016, because we've been so careful to make it, to make it bipartisan. And, unfortunately, when you do things like this, you don't get as much coverage on MSNBC and Fox News because they're interested in talking about the places where the two parties are fighting.
Yeah. Ratcheting things out globally, but focusing on our Connecticut listeners, and it's always challenging for me to be talking to you on a Thursday when the program's going to broadcast on a Sunday. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that we don't hear about any other further tragedies in between. But with your work on the Foreign Relations Committee, I'd like your perspective on, as you're back over the holidays and you're talking to constituents, not just here in Connecticut, but primarily, say, for here in Connecticut, what are the one or two biggest misconceptions that people have about ISIS and terrorism as we speak right now?
Well, I think one of the biggest misconceptions people have is that ISIS is winning. Now, it's easy to take that view when you see the terror and destruction that they've levied on places like Paris, the attacks that they inspired in places like San Bernardino. But inside Iraq and Syria, they're on the run. They've lost 30% of their territory since the beginning of last year. They just lost one of their major cities in Iraq, Ramadi, a few weeks ago. And part of the reason that they are now focused on attacks in places like Paris or in the United States is because they no longer are expansionists inside of the Middle East. These guys are a threat to the United States. They are, but they're not 10 feet tall. I mean, they're probably 6'7". They're serious, but they aren't limitless in their capacity, and we're going to get them. We're going to destroy them. It's not going to happen overnight, just like they weren't created overnight. Remember, ISIS didn't just show up a year and a half ago. They are the follow-on organization to a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq that we've been fighting since we invaded in 2003. So we'll get them. We'll destroy them. We're making progress in the right direction. And while people should be concerned, they shouldn't live their lives in fear. I mean, they should not live their lives in fear that they are going to be a victim of a terrorist attack, because it's much more likely that your life will be taken some other way than it will be by an ISIS sympathizer. It doesn't mean that we're not taking them seriously, but I don't want people to sort of lock down because of everything that they see on the news.
Yeah, because there does every time one of these attacks happens, no matter where it is in the world, the 24-hour news cycle instills fuels the flame of this fear, this underlying stress that I think so many of us are under today.
Dozens of people every day die from gun homicides, die from shootings that happen in their home or on the street, and there have been people in this country who have been killed by terrorists or by individuals that were inspired by terrorists, but those numbers pale in comparison to those that have been killed by guns for lots of other reasons. And so it's just important to put this threat in perspective. I'll be honest with you, I spend an enormous amount of my time on this issue, the campaign to fight ISIS. I'm dedicated to it. I'm dedicated to getting rid of these guys. But what they want is for this country to lock down and be paralyzed by fear. That is the definition of terrorism, to spread fear beyond the reality of the actual threat. And so when I hear these proposals to, you know, lock our doors to, you know, anybody who follows the Muslim faith, or to just shut down our doors completely, as some people have suggested, to all immigration, I know that the terrorists are winning in that respect, that they've made people that fearful that they're proposing to do irrational things. Let's be smart about how we beat these guys, and we'll get them. Let's not overreact.
Great. Good input, and always a pleasure to speak with you. I learn a lot every time we get on the line together. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy with us to open up the program this morning. Best of luck to you, Chris. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you again soon. Well, there's nothing that people like more than puppies, and I guess there's no better way to enjoy a puppy than to know that the puppy that you're taking care of is going to go out into the world and do good, and there are not many puppies that do more good than those from Guiding Eyes for the Blind. Guiding Eyes for the Blind is an internationally accredited nonprofit providing guide dogs to people with vision loss, as well as service dogs to children with autism. We are pleased to be joined by a trio of guests on the line today, and we're opening it up with Linda D'Amato, who is the director of the puppy program for Guiding Eyes for the Blind. We're going to talk to her for a little while, take a little break. When we come back, we're going to meet Becky Davidson, who's manager of consumer outreach and graduate services, and Becky, also sight impaired, is going to talk a little bit about her experiences with guide dogs from the organization. She is on her third. And then we're going to meet Lorraine Trapponi, who's a puppy raiser, who's going to educate us on all of the things we might need to know if we want to volunteer to raise and take care of dogs that will eventually transition to clients of Guiding Eyes for the Blind. So, Linda, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks so much, John. We're really excited to be here. It's I get goosebumps a lot talking about the work that we do, and it's amazing. Our mission is, and we're very passionate about connecting dogs, exceptional dogs, with individuals and families, really for their greater independence. What that means is helping people meet their life's goals. And it's an amazing mission. And how do we do that? We've been a guide dog school since in the 1950s, and we have approximately 450 dogs on our puppy program right now. And these dogs are all along the East Coast. The volunteers are raising them, and they're from Maine down to North Carolina and out to as far west as Ohio. And people get these puppies, they get a really good training class, they get the puppies when they are 8 weeks of age, and then they're supported through the whole time that they have the puppy by attending weekly classes until the puppies are 20 weeks of age, and then every other week they go to class. And there's no prior dog training necessary. This is for people who have a passion for the mission and for people who love dogs. They are amazing puppies. They're all born in at our Canine Development Center in Paterson, New York. And we start training them at a very, very young age. And by the way, if you hear a little squeaking here, Lawson, Becky Davidson's guide dog, is here, and he's making sure that he has a voice here. So he was squeaking with his toy. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, that's fine.
So it's really quite a journey. And I will tell you of the my volunteers, I would say 99% of the people say that they got more than they gave. These are amazing dogs. They're specially bred dogs. We have our own breeding colony of dogs, and we breed for really superior genetics. And these dogs will have somebody's life in their hands, their safety. Mm-hmm. And we want them to be in the superior health. And they get amazing care every step of the way. They start massage at a very young age, like they're about 10 days old, so that they really love being handled by humans, and they're comfortable, they know they're safe, and in good hands, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So,
quite literally.
I'm sorry?
I said quite literally, in good hands.
In very good hands, absolutely. Yeah, good point.
So I wanted to ask.
And you know, it's interesting because the quite often people say to us, and I will, when Lorraine talks, she can answer this question very well. But people often say to us, "How do you give them up after you've had them in your life?" And you're really doing this volunteer opportunity for someone else because it makes such a difference.
Well,
but along the way, you get so many benefits from it.
Yeah, that's a good point because when I first was talking with you and we were putting the program together, my thought is that there's kind of, I guess, three kinds of people in this world. The ones that don't like dogs, who I don't particularly get along with for the most part. Those who love dogs and love owning dogs and who would never dream of owning a dog and then giving it up even for a greater good potentially. And then there are those who I think represent a lot of people who love dogs and would love to have dogs in their lives, but can't see themselves 5 years or 10 years or 15 years from now being able to be continuously committed to that pet. And yet they're somewhat unfulfilled because they don't have those friendly four-legged friends in their lives. And so Guiding Eyes offers a spectacular opportunity for these people to not only be able to enjoy having dogs in their lives, but also who are moving toward that fulfilling that greater good and then turning those dogs around into service and companion animals for those more needy. So I imagine you probably get a lot of the last two coming to you, and maybe you convert a good number of those people who couldn't ever dream of taking a puppy and then sending it back out 6 or 8 months later. So tell us a little bit about the folks that come to Guiding Eyes. Do you have to be a dog trainer or have to have taken extensive dog behavioral classes? How do folks with no experience but who really want to do something for Guiding Eyes in terms of facilitating the provision of these wonderful dogs? How do they learn how to do that?
Well, when I tell you no previous dog experience is necessary, it's 100% true. There are people who come from all walks of life. I mean, this is not for a particular age group. We have kids raising, we have senior citizens raising, people living in the country, people living in New York City, it's amazing. And we teach people. Because it's We have a really great program. It's all based on relationship-centered training. So it's building the relationship with the dog, and that means you play with the dog, you walk with the dog. The teaching of obedience is really pretty simple. And we have excellent, very consistent training programs, so people learn it all. And they get a huge, huge amount of support during the way, along the way.
Mm-hmm.
We also offer medical benefits or veterinary services for the dogs, so that that's not out of pocket. But anybody who wants to try this, they can come and take what we call our pre-placement classes and see if it's right for them. The benefits are huge. And it's fun. I mean, one of our goals we start off saying right away is we want you to have fun with this. Because when this dog is out working, they're having fun.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, they love what they're doing. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. They wouldn't be selected for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
They are really motivated, and they're absolutely connected with their person. And the first step is they're connected with their puppy raiser.
Great.
Well, it's an amazing process.
It's important to remind people that dogs not suited for guide work can become service dogs, as we said, for children on the autism spectrum. And also that all services are offered free of charge to individuals who are visually impaired and to families with children on the spectrum. And it's also important to point out that all of these services come supported by all of the wonderful volunteers and staff and folks like yourself, but there is a significant expense, and so Guiding Eyes, of course, also would welcome contributions to fulfill its mission to their headquarters and training center, either in Yorktown Heights or their development center in Paterson, New York. So if you'd like to find out more, guidingeyes.org is the place to start. And with that, we've kind of hit our midpoint mark. So we're going to give a little bit of a break to our first guest on the program, Linda D'Amato. She's director of the puppy program for Guiding Eyes for the Blind. We're going to take a couple moments while Linda hands over the phone, and we're going to meet Becky Davidson on the flip side. So, Linda, we'll come back to you in just about 8 or 9 minutes just to get some final details, and we'll talk to Becky right after the break. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this. Despite a decline in the state's annual home energy affordability gap, there are still more than 313,000 Connecticut households that can't afford to pay their energy bills. Operation Fuel, Connecticut's only statewide nonprofit energy assistance program, provides energy assistance to more than 8,300 households this year. But due to limited resources, Operation Fuel can only help a fraction of the households that can't afford their energy bills. But there are a number of ways you can help or get help. So learn more. Just visit their website, operationfuel.org. Hi, we're back with Becky Davidson. She's manager of consumer outreach and graduate services and an ideal person to talk about the great dogs and the great work that these dogs do. She is on her third Guiding Eyes for the Blind dog that we heard a little bit of in the background. So Becky, in the 4 or 5 minutes that we have with you, let's talk a little bit about the impact of having a guide dog and that journey from your first one to your current one. What is it like the first time you're introduced and oriented to having that a canine extension of yourself?
It's quite a learning process, really. I'll just give you a little bit of background. I've been blind all my life, and I did not choose to get a guide dog until I was in my 40s. And now it's been 21 years of guide dog work. But the biggest impact probably people who are blind or low vision, you've probably seen people walking with the white cane.
Mm-hmm.
And the primary difference is that a cane is what we refer to as an object detector. You're walking down the street and you're using your cane ahead of you. You find something and you have to figure out what it is and make your way around it. Okay, so you're getting a lot of tactile information from the cane. The dog, on the other hand, is an object avoider. So you're walking down the same street, there's a bike in the middle of the sidewalk. The dog will choose which is the safest direction to go, to the right or to the left of the bike. You probably won't even slow your pace much. You'll just sidestep with your dog, go around the obstacle, and continue on your way.
Yes, it's almost like they're leading you in a wonderful dance.
It really kind of is, but it's a different type of experience. Personally, I found that once I started working with my first dog, my posture improved, my confidence level certainly improved, and having the sense of having this dog beside you who's filling in a gap for you. In other words, I can hear what's going on around, I can feel with my feet, I can sense the environment around me, but I can't see it. But this dog next to me can.
Mm.
And so, you know, I put my trust in the dog to keep me safe, to keep me from walking off of curbs or falling down steps or smacking into poles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a remarkable teamwork. And it does take some time to build the relationship with the dog. That's why we have classes here that are 3 weeks long, so that you can learn what your dog already knows, and then the two of you become a partnership. We refer to it as guide dog teams, the person and dog together as a team. In my own experience, I knew other people who worked with guide dogs before I got one.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of them, but I did. And no matter how prepared you are, you think you are for that first walk with the dog in harness, there's a lot of emotion that happens when you do it for the first time.
Mm.
It's just a remarkable experience. It's just such a sense. Some of our students refer to their dogs as their sports car.
Mm.
You know, different things like that. And actually, if people are curious, in addition to all the puppy raising information that's on www.guidingeyes.org, we have profiles of many of the students who come into class and tell a little bit of their life story so that people can understand that it's not just, okay, fine, you've got a dog. It's you've got this partner that you together are making your way safely through your days and through your environment.
Mm. Well, Becky, my final question to you before we go on and meet Lorraine and hear a little bit about puppy raising is if you could possibly fix a percentage to things that, based on what you recall from before you had your first dog to now, what percentage of things do you think you would not be doing that you are doing today if you had never been introduced to and began using a guide dog?
Wow.
Do you think you'd be significantly less active and out there and doing things, or just a little bit less?
Oh, I think it would be significant.
So it makes a huge difference.
It does make a huge difference in terms of, sometimes the difference is just a matter of feeling the self-confidence and the emotional boost of having the dog with you and knowing that you can trust the dog and the two of you together, you know, you can figure it out. You can make your way. That's hugely important. My job entails a lot of travel and going into new places for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And just needing to figure things out.
Okay.
And of course you would ask for help, but you know, anybody can ask for help in a new situation.
Excellent.
But well, I feel much braver with my dog.
Fantastic.
I guess is the best way to put it.
Great. Becky Davidson is manager of consumer outreach and graduate services. You can hear why. She is also one of our trio representing Guiding Eyes for the Blind. GuidingEyes.org is the website to go to learn more. And our final guest for the last 3 or 4 minutes is going to be Lorraine Triponi, who is a puppy raiser. So, Becky, if you can hand off to Lorraine, we will finish up with her. And we will find out what some of the major concerns and challenges are that she helps folks overcome as they acquire puppies for Guiding Eyes. Hi, Lorraine. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank
you,
Lorraine. John.
Yeah, thanks for joining us in the last few minutes that we have. Can you tell me a couple of the greatest concerns that people have when they come to you that you're able to coach them through on to being successful puppy raisers like yourself?
Well, I'm actually a puppy raiser, not a trainer.
Oh,
of
I see.
Puppy
oh,
raisers.
Okay. So I apologize. You've raised 4 puppies.
Yes.
So far. So what were a couple of the concerns that you had as you were coming on to the program?
I had no dog experience. I just had a tremendous desire to volunteer with Guiding Eyes for the Blind and raise puppies in the hopes of changing a life. When I embarked on that, I had no idea that my own life would be the one that was changed the most.
And as you meet people in the course of the time that you've been working with Guiding Eyes, what are some of the questions that they ask, or some of the things they might be surprised to learn from you?
Well, I think the first concern that people who are considering raising a puppy share with me is I could never give the puppy up. And the way that I overcame that for myself, first of all, I had a very clear idea of why I was volunteering. I wanted to be able to change a life and raise a puppy in honor of my deceased husband, who had partially lost his vision during the course of his illness. So I understood the challenges that visual impairment could present in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Guiding Eyes for the Blind has a graduation ceremony once a month that's open to the public, and these ceremonies are incredibly moving. Coming to a ceremony and hearing testaments from people who are receiving their dogs and the difference that it means to them makes the task of giving up this puppy that you've nurtured and loved as if he's your own puppy for a year easy, because you know that the puppies are going to someone who's going to love them as much as you do, that is going to give them a happy, productive life, that the puppy will never be alone because he's with his partner 100% of the time.
Oh, okay, great. Well, that's great. Great information, and I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to just give folks the perspective from the puppy raiser herself, Lorraine Triponi, with us, another wonderful volunteer for Guiding Eyes for the Blind. GuidingEyes.org is the website you need to go to learn more. And Lorraine, if I could just ask you to hand the phone back to Linda, we're going to tell all the folks listening how they can get involved once again. So Linda D'Amato is back with us. She is director of the puppy program for Guiding Eyes of the Blind. And Linda, we've got about a minute. If you could just walk people through phone numbers, websites, anything that they might need to know if they're interested in jumping right in to try to help now. Where folks could go if they want to donate in order to support this great program.
Thanks again, John. Well, I think the best place to go is our website. It's www.guidingeyes.org. And to find out more about puppy raising, there's a link on the front of the website where you can click on that, click on locations. We have 5 locations in Connecticut. And also to find out about donations. It takes a great team of people. It takes donors. One guide dog will cost us about $50,000. So it takes us an amazing team. It really takes a village to raise a puppy, because you have the raisers, you have the staff, and you have the donors who support this incredible work. And we're helping people all over the world. We're in 25 countries also helping other schools learn this.
That's great. They are an accredited member of the International Guide Dog Federation, Guiding Eyes, a 501c3 nonprofit providing superbly bred and trained guide dogs to men and women who are visually impaired, as well as dogs that can become service and companion animals for children on the autism spectrum. GuidingEyes.org is the website. If you're ever interested in learning about getting involved with some four-legged friends, they can help with that, as they can help you if you'd like to support the great work that Guiding Eyes is doing. I'd like to once again thank our guests this morning: Linda D'Amato, director of the Puppy Program; Becky Davidson, manager of consumer outreach and a multiple dog owner herself; and LaRanger Pony, puppy raiser with Guiding Eyes for the Blind. Folks, great show this morning. Thanks for being part of our program. So we always enjoy making new friends, and Jeff Block is the latest and greatest friend of the award-winning For the People here. Sadly, we have to make his acquaintance just ahead of a very tragic anniversary. Jeff is the founder of One Innocent Life. You can learn more about them at oneinnocentlife.org. On January 21st, 2012, his daughter, along with two of her college cohorts, lost their lives in an off-campus fire at Marist College. And as a result, One Innocent Life was born. One Innocent Life is dedicated to raising awareness about the living conditions of college students involving fire safety. So this is going to be a great segment to listen to, whether your little ones are still little, or they're going away to college this coming year, or if they're in college already, all the way up through through graduate school and beyond. So great information today from Jeff. So, Jeff, great to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you too, John. One Innocent Life started in August of this year, essentially. Mm-hmm. July, really. We formed in July. We got our 501c3 in August of this year. And starting with a Facebook page, we've visited with universities in the area. We are currently looking to do some videotapes that would bring this to life to the college students. The issue comes down to the 18 to 24-year-old indestructible years. Mm-hmm. And the first time they're away from home, they're moving out of their parents' house, and universities don't have enough dormitory space. So they live off campus, and it's the life that you want to live. You want to be alive. You want to be the first time outside of your world.
Sure. Some colleges don't even have dorms.
Correct. And what we have is a problem with the off-campus housing, because people are renters. And there's different areas of where they can get their places from. And me as a parent, I didn't know. I mean, to be honest with you, what my daughter was getting into, I didn't know it was close to school. I knew it was approved by the university at that point. What we could do is we felt protected and comfortable. Mm-hmm. What really is now is what I'm finding out is that you're not. This university considers you an adult. So they don't have, and they consider you off campus. So you consider what you are is essentially
almost a commuter.
A commuter. You're considered a commuter. That's it. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
You're considered a commuter. They don't even have an address for you. So you as a student need to be prepared and need to think about what's going to happen in case there is a fire in your place.
So does that mean that anybody who's considering living anywhere off campus, whether they're going in as a freshman or at some point in their later years of higher education, that they need to walk into any prospective place where they might live with kind of a new set of eyes?
Oh, definitely, because if you look at what code is, and code by the fire laws is by NFPA and the ICC in Connecticut here, it's the minimum requirements that you need to have in a house. And if a house is built before 1978, according to code, you don't even need to have one single smoke detector in it. Mm. Okay. After that, they require a smoke detector. They don't just tell you what type. And there's two different types of smoke detectors out there. The one's an ionization smoke detector, mainly made for flash fires, but it's in 90% of all the homes. Okay. Then there's the photoelectric one, which will detect smoke a lot quicker, probably 15 to 50 minutes quicker than an ionization smoke detector will. Most fires occur when people are sleeping. It's a smoldering type of fire, so there's more smoke. They don't have 15 minutes for the alarm to go off for them to get out of there safely.
Well, aren't some of the criticisms that I think I've heard about the electronic smoke detectors and why they are not prolifically installed in a lot of homes and private homes and multifamily or apartment-style locations is because they, especially when homes are hardwired into an alarm system, they can go off so frequently. In other words, they could be tripped much more easily by steam or even, a well-done, not even burned piece of toast or something like that?
Well, in a kitchen area where there's a potential for a flash fire, you would want an ionization smoke detector or a heat sensor.
Mm-hmm.
But not in the sleeping areas, in the hallways.
Oh, right.
Okay, so we're the most potential for people to be sleeping at, for the alarm to go off for them to hear it. And you do want the whole thing wired, hardwired together, or in a wireless system, where when one goes off, they all go off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but code doesn't require that type of information.
Mm-hmm. So could I walk into my neighborhood hardware store and buy a photoelectric or ask if they have the two versions?
Yes, you can. I've seen them from anywhere between $16 to $24 to $100.
Oh, okay.
So you can get, they're prolific, they're out there. What happened was, when the original smoke detectors came out, UL put the specification together. That specification was built in 1970. Very little has changed within that specification, and that's why ionization detectors are still out there in the marketplace. In 2008, the International Firefighters Association, 300 union firefighters went to the United States Senate and said, got to get rid of these things, these ionization smoke detectors. Prolifically, we would want, and nothing's happened since then. I think California has changed their law where they require you to put photoelectric smoke detectors in, but generally, most people don't require them. So it's something that you as a parent or you as a student should take a look at, even in your own home today, right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we think we're protected. We have this false sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
We protect our things more because everybody has a security system in their house. Everybody's worried about somebody breaking in and taking things, but they're not considering their lives, which is, to me, more important than my things.
Right.
Okay, if I had the chance to do it over again, I'd want my daughter back, okay? If everything else burnt out and she lost everything, that's okay. I mean, everything could be replaced by a human being.
Yeah.
And that's the toughest thing that we're indestructible at 18 to 24.
Mm-hmm.
And being indestructible at 18 to 24, we don't think about that. We're not concerned with taking that responsibility for ourselves because nothing's going to happen to us.
Right, but it's one thing at that age or any age to not be mindful, to not be proactive in ensuring a place that you're buying or renting has not only smoke detectors, but perhaps sprinklers as well. If it's a more kind of commercial complex, duplex apartments, what have you. I guess there's that inherent expectation that if you're slapping down money for rent, you're getting at least like the basic level of fire safety protection.
Well, that you should be. Okay. A couple of universities I had spoken to had tried to have programs where landlords would have the fire inspector or the fire marshal come into their homes and inspect them and say, okay, this will bless this type of situation.
Yes, pass.
And it passes. But, if the landlord's out of specification, why is he going to go in and have the fire marshal come in? There's no need for that. And in a single family or a duplex home, without the owner's consent, they're not even allowed in there. So if you're a renter, you have to be very wary of that situation by asking them. I would say, go ahead and ask them, can we have the fire marshal come in before I rent this place? I mean, that's just take that and push that to the top of your memory because you don't have it. Once you rent that place, you don't have the right to have the fire marshal come in.
Yeah, that's an interesting tactic because I imagine just body language alone might, to that question, may dictate whether or not you want to lay that security deposit down and set yourself up to move in. We're about halfway through a conversation with Jeff Block. Sadly, he lost his daughter almost 4 years ago to a fire at an off-campus facility near Marist College. His daughter, along with two of her roommates or friends, passed in that incident. As a result, just a few months ago, he began establishing a 501c3 nonprofit called One Innocent Life. You can visit them at oneinnocentlife.org. That website is just poised to or going live almost as we speak. You can go to that website for lots of background and information on the cause, as well as some safety information and referral links that will help you to keep yourself or your loved ones, your children safe, whether they're going to be going to college many years down the road or they're poised to go to college this fall, or maybe they're already in college. So, Jeff, I did touch upon the subject of sprinklers. Is that another issue that your organization is paying attention to or helping to educate people on?
Well, we've had a bill passed within the state of Connecticut in the implementer 1502, section 57, where now in your lease, you need to be notified after October 1st this year, in Connecticut anyway, whether there's an operative or inoperative sprinkler system within the building. And if there is an operative one, when was the last date of inspection, when was the last date of maintenance? That bill essentially gives you something to think about. Look for it in your lease. Do I want to make a decision to live here? We're not trying to tell people what to do. But what we can do is give them
lessees and rental tenants?
It's from single-family home to multifamily apartment houses.
Okay.
So any building within the state of Connecticut right now should have that in their lease from a residential. From a residential standpoint. Funny thing about that, though, finding out that I talked to a friend of mine the other day, and she just moved into her place in November, and I said, well, let's take a look. It wasn't in her lease. So I called up the state attorney's office for housing, and I called up the state fire marshal's office. And neither one of them had heard about the bill, first of all. Second of all, neither one of them knew who was to enforce it. So the information is not out there. Mm. The only way we're able to get this information is by you giving me a chance to talk on the radio. Mm. We need to take care of that. It's not currently, people aren't currently aware of it.
Yeah, so this is clearly a case where the law has arrived. It's on the books and in effect. And apparently, at least a number, if not the majority of people who need to abide by it or enforce it may not even be aware that it's in effect yet.
Well, according to the state's attorney's office for housing said, there is no enforcement for the bill. So the only thing that people can do is, if it's not in their lease, is essentially not pay their rent, and the landlord is supposedly in breach of contract because that's supposed to be in their lease. So I think it's kind of ironic in certain respects, because this was one of the fights that we were having to get this bill through originally. They were worried about something like this occurring, and now they've made it what they didn't want it to be. Instead of just having somebody have a $25 ticket or something like that, a fine or something like that, some enforcement rules along with it, there's nothing to go along with it. So it's sort of difficult.
A little bit of a hollow victory.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So I guess with the last few minutes that we have with you, Jeff Block, let's talk about the things that parents and loved ones and guardians need to know, and the kind of advice you need to give them if and when their child is going away and they are going to be opting toward an off-campus residence versus an on-campus residence.
Well, first, I would ask the landlord if they would allow the fire marshal to come in and inspect that place. Second, if it's depending on when the building was built, I would bring in extra smoke detectors. Make sure that they have the photoelectric smoke detectors in their bedrooms and in the hallways.
So make that sort of like one of the little going away presents.
Exactly. Just bring them in, hang them up. I mean, just do them for the kids.
Yeah. And you have to ask for photoelectric, not ionized.
Correct.
Smoke alarm. So when you go to your hardware store, or you go online to order, you have to get the photoelectric.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly recommend those. 15 to 19 minutes, 50 minutes, it can still save your life. Mm-hmm. It'll get you out the door. Make sure you know there's two ways out. Make sure that the egresses for the windows are large enough in case there is a fire that you can get through them.
Or they're not barred shut.
Exactly. Make sure that you can know two ways out of that building. Look for potentials. Make sure you have enough electrical outlets in that apartment, because kids today use more electrical equipment than any time before. You don't want an octopus sitting on the floor. Little things like that. So one of the couple of things that we're going to be trying to do with One Innocent Life is essentially put some videos together for educational purposes. Something that's a little bit shock and awe, maybe, that'll be coming out in the next, hopefully by the springtime. Mm-hmm. One of the things, projects we're working on, and then something a little comical. Because if you want to get the 18 to 24-year-old demographic, I think you have to scare the living daylights out of them first. Get them to be...
Or hit them with something that's engaging.
Exactly. And then you want to bring a little humor into the situation, because I don't want it to be, you know, all about the horror that happened to me. I want it to be about education. I want it to be, let's take this, because if we can get those kids, 18 to 24 years old, we can essentially say they'll take that to their families when they grow up, when they have kids of their own. It'll bring this to the forefront, and everybody will be more aware of what is necessary for fire safety. Because when we were in third and fourth grades, I remember coming home and being so excited about... Mm-hmm.
Home fire drill.
Home fire drill, everything.
Yeah, everybody meets in the same place down the street.
Exactly. Yeah. But when you get to that, you know, 18 years old, you haven't had that reinforced again.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, we feel very comfortable. But it's missing.
Yeah.
Because we're not thinking about it any longer. We think the firemen are going to protect us. They're there to put the fire out. They're not going to be able to get there fast enough to save our lives.
Fire prevention for next gen, oneinnocentlife.org. My guest today is Jeff Block, founder of One Innocent Life. On January 21st, he will look back 4 years on the sad and tragic death of his daughter and two of her friends during a fire at Marist College, while at the same time celebrating the launch of oneinnocentlife.org, an informational website that he's designing to ensure that no other parent has to undergo the tragedy that Jeff and his family suffered on January 21st, 2012. Oneinnocentlife.org is the site. We hope you visit it. And Jeff, thanks so much for being part of the program.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voket, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.